talk, and I said I would like to do it, but this stress was going to be put together up in something of a haste after the world's meeting. So I'd really like people to think of this as more of sort of a less room, informal common foundations discussion than a room before. So I'd very much welcome interaction and questions. If you don't ask me questions, I'm going to start asking you questions. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Real world interpretations, why that name? Well, I suppose the idea was something like this, that we're still trying to have to decide, so I'm not sure whether or not we can make any sense of any world's interpretation. But somewhere out there, anyway, is the name of many worlds. And the picture here, which is something like that we have a precise version of the branching structure in many worlds. But we're not going to play a many worlds game. We're going to say we now have a list of possible branches, we have a list of probabilities of those branches. Just one of those is realized. That's the real world. So it has a sort of precise probabilistic ontology, which, as discussed in a minute, is something that it shares in common with various other interpretation algorithms, for instance, the Brown or class ones. It's a program. There are new ideas in there. There's a clear set of mathematical rules that either will work or will not work, that should be applied to particular structures that define the interpretation. And there's a small list of possible structures that need to be explored. If it really doesn't work, it can't be made to work for any of them, then it's dead. The idea is to solve the measurement problem. The idea is to give a precise mathematical account of reality that's consistent with an experiment. The way things are set up...
If it doesn't do what, it's dead?
Well, if it doesn't give a precise mathematical account of reality that's consistent with an experiment, it's dead. The way things are set up,
in a natural sense, it respects Lorentz invariance, and in a natural sense, it respects conservation laws, although there's more that could be said on both those points. But I think it's fair to say that that's the right summary. I'll discuss this more in a moment, later, but it's at least not immediately evident that there's a tails problem. It's not immediately evident that these branches tell a story which says roughly that the world is dominated in amplitude by stuff that looks one way but has little ghostly small amplitude pieces attached to it that if you took them in isolation would tell a very different story about a quasi-classical world.
Roughly.
Should I say more about that?
I've never heard of it.
You've never heard of it before. Okay, so I will say more about that. So you're familiar with GI, I believe, class theory, for instance. So GIW is often said to have a tails problem. So if you do a GRW analysis of a quantum system that's a mixture of up and down, like so, that interacts with an apparatus that's actually got a point one way or the other, so and then the point is at rest. Well, the unitary evolution will take you to up, and then Poynter swings into up Poynter state plus down. Poynter and down state. So this is quantum. This is Poynter. This is one particle. This is 10 to 23 particles. But so far, we've just followed unitary quantum mechanics. And then GRW tells you that you expect this to undergo collapses. And what a collapse does, well, firstly, it's going to be one of the particles in the point of the collapses, almost certainly. But what that does is multiply the whole thing by a Gaussian prefactor, which has the form, which has the property that one of these terms will dominate and the other one will be almost killed. So we get something like one minus epsilon plus
So it's still a pure state.
So it's indeed, it's still a pure state, but it's a pure state that's undergone a collapse that's maybe either a pure state of this form or a pure state of essentially another form, and I've chosen one of these. So, okay. So, first approximation, this is the sort of thing we wanted from the ontology. We can say, well, you know, this thing is pretty negligible, and this thing is telling us this consistent story about the pointer and everything that's pointing up. And not just the first GRW collapse, but later collapses are very likely, almost certainly, to just reinforce that story. So this will become 1 minus something even smaller. Epsilon prime is much, much smaller than epsilon, which is like much, much smaller than 1. Okay, so, and very, very likely that if we follow the GRW collapses through, they will just carry over equally that stuff. So we have the first approximation consistent on ontological statement which shows it. This stuff over on the right is negligible after the first collapse, it just gets more and more negligible. The stuff over to the left is going to story about classical pointer pointing upwards. First approximation. But we haven't actually killed these terms. They're still there in the wave function. And if one so we have so this is large and this is okay. But we're interested in the inflation comment to get to these. Well, they both still have information content, even though this one has much more activity. And this one, the information content of this one, is talking about a world in which the point went the other way. And it carries on at least through good well, maybe get some story about how things eventually disappear from us. But it carries on telling a consistent alternative story about us, so to speak, the shadow classical world, the one that we don't think it's with us. But if, then we start one, then you might at least start wondering, well, if I were trying to make sense of something like Everett that I asked about that, looked at the wave function, I would say, well, these alternative worlds really are there, pretty much regardless of the weights attached to it. And if that's true in Everett, why isn't that true here also? Is that, are both these worlds? Still part of the ontology. Well, certainly this thing, the wave function, presumably is part of it, still part of the ontology, since our definition of the ontology of GLW in the orthodox view of GLW at least is that it includes the wave function, perhaps is precisely the wave function. So it looks as though maybe the answer is yes, plausibly. At least, or arguably.
But now that they change it, they talk about mass densities and so on, so they don't identify the ontology in the wave function, right? You construct something like a mass density.
You construct mass densities, but that in itself isn't going to proceed from this, because you just have a picture of a very sort of fat, thick set of mass densities that are describing the world. But a little ghostly one has a different structure that's somewhere over there, but it's still there. It's not clear it's negligible, even in the mass density.
But mathematical densities in space.
Yeah, I understand. Here's the point that it was realized.
Yes.
So if we look at the mass density of the wave function, it's sort of really thick. It's essentially the density of the point of it. But there's still a little ghostly thing pointing the other way in mass density terms. It's in what would otherwise be empty space. So what do we say about it? Do we say that we stop caring about it once the density gets below some critical number? We could say that, but it seems a slightly ad hoc rule to do it.
Well, I mean, even this object has an electric field that lies off by distance, right? So if this is my pointer, there's some ghostly part of it here as well, right? And dies off. So is it really a problem?
It's not. That seems like it's different story. That doesn't seem like a problem. That's just a fact of that.
But
pointers so that you associate with them. But here we have, you can ask it much about pointers about people. I mean, we seem to have all the ingredients we need, at least on the functional account, to talk about conscious creatures in both the sort of thick, heavy bit and in the shadow bit of the wave function.
But what that shadow, it's not really there. The signal to noise is very small. There's the density of the air molecules and all this other stuff. You're just talking about a tiny perturbation.
So you things get complicated. You might be able to risk it out by some sort of discussion like that, but it's not so clear, because after all, there's more to structure than just the sort of volume average mass density. I mean, the air molecules have different properties. And do you want to tell a story that says, well, you know, things collapse as long as they're in the air, but if you have stuff happening in complete vacuum, then they're really there. Do you want to tell a story that says that human beings really exist in superpositions as long as they go out into deep space? It's not so obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you do.
It seems to me, you'd be okay if you told that story. Such the cases with that happens is so rare. There's always a 3-degree microwave background. These are exponentially small things, very, very small. I don't think you'll find any really. If someone claimed that you found an absolutely, truly empty thing with an effective density of less than 10 to the minus 500 grams per cubic centimeter, maybe there would be enough. It's not good that it's coming.
I agree with that last thing. It's not totally clear one way or the other to me either whether it's a problem or something you should worry about. But I think it's something you should worry about. I'm not sure whether it's a devastating problem for GLW or something you can get around by other ways. But all else being equal, I guess you might be better off in a situation where it wasn't there is all the potential where it goes.
Well, he was first.
Okay, sorry.
Well, why are you all already, why are you not talking about telling the story? I mean, you started out saying that you're going to lay out some mathematical rules that you would batch observation. So is this story somehow, Right. I mean, is this a slip or is it the story you tell there on what you consider the observations?
This was a bit of a detour because there was a discussion of GRW or what the table of common means in that context. What I was I'm going to get back to my own story, which is not aligned with this story.
Well, I definitely want to bring a remark that, which is relevant to this. About 2 years ago, I wrote a short paper on this problem. We provided an example. Mathematical agreement is an example of a stochastic collapse model where the collapse is complete after a finite amount of time. So this is just, I mean, and as far as I know, this is the only example of such a model. But nevertheless, it dispels any doubt about the matter. It's perfectly consistent to have stochastic collapse models with no tails. It's just that the previous models that have been produced didn't have
That's tails. Tricky. So that. I wasn't sure I understood the statement. That's true for anything you could plausibly think of as a measurement situation, or any situation where aspect structure emerges from states, or it's true in particular toroidals.
People were making the opposite remark. They were extrapolating from this flaw, if you like, in the GRW model and saying this is a general feature of stochastic reduction models, but that's not true.
Come back to that talk, please. Continue this sort of overview. So we're dealing with the branching structure. The branches are going to be defined by mixed states and not pure states. We're not in general orthogonal, not perfectly orthogonal, at least at finite time. But they do become perfectly orthogonal, and by the way, they also become pure states. Why would you want to do such a thing, given all the other interesting interpretational ideas that are already out there? Well, I think there are at least two good lines of motivation for a program such as this one. The first is that it's a genuinely new attempt to solve the measurement problem, and it offers a new fundamental ontology, new realist interpretation of quantum theory. Or since there are actually a few options to try, maybe more so, say, a small class of new realist interpretations. And it's quantum theory of a coexistence, so in principle, this is something that should apply to the universe, as far as we have a quantum theory of gravity and matter. It's an option to be considered alongside the Broglie mode of interpretation of dead elephant collapse models. And the point, and I'll say more about this in the next slide or two, which is we're painfully aware of difficulties with all the vertical branches, and it has at least potentially some advantages in the region. Okay, so that first motivation is addressed to ontology. Clearly, there are many people who are interested in quantum theory, cosmology, but I'm not ontology people, so they shorthand. I simply am not committed to the idea that one needs an interpretation of quantum theory to do this. There is motivation for this side of thought. So, for Evertians who think they already have a perfectly good ontology, or ontological agnostics who just don't know whether or not it's something worth considering, or epistemic programmers who might or might not think that some alternative ontology will eventually emerge from their program, depending on what stripe of epistemic person they are. We need something else apart from electronic cosmology. I think everybody agrees on that. Well, not everybody agrees on that. We need an account of what quasi-classical worlds look like. So I'm struggling with language here, and this is probably my fault. I mean, you might call it a phenomenology, except that term tends to be, well, has already been used, means somewhat different things. So I don't mean by phenomenology what I suppose it normally means, which is a description of the world of ideas and sensations and thoughts and some attempt to account for physics by a description vessel. I mean a description of a quasi-classical world emerging, you know, from the early universe, and structure beginning to emerge, galaxies being seeded, stars and planets forming, and everything here. All these pretty roughly classical things that happened on Earth since then and will carry on happening long after we've stopped worrying about the whole picture. I warned you, I guess, to start asking questions. There must be a better word than phenomenology. What is the word?
Model.
Modeling. Okay. Thank you. Except that's right. It can't be a little model sort of covers that, but it means so many different things to so many different people. Is there? Is there anyone?
A lot of people in my class.
Yeah. All right. That's clearly something we need to do. Even if, say, we're an Everettian, we think we've already solved the vision problem, we haven't solved the problem of how to do science within Newtonian until we find out of quasi-classical worlds, until we can say something about what sort of world we'd like to find ourselves in mathematical terms. Why try and do that this way when there are many other approaches that are trying to do something rather similar? In particular, because it's an historic test, I think we'd say. Why try and devise a new set of rules to do this when that's what we've already been doing? Why not work within a consistent histories approach and try to produce a set selection rule, some precise mathematical criteria? We'll pick out a unique, consistent set that defines quasi-classical today. Well, I certainly don't want to say that that would be a bad thing to do. It wouldn't. That would be a great thing to do if we could do it. And it would be very interesting. It's not clear to me that it would necessarily be better than what I'm about to describe, but it would be very interesting and independently interesting. But it does look very, very, very hard to do. Go on and half floor. Were initially, I think, quite optimistic, spent a lot of time trying, at least setting out a program of trying to find mathematical measures of quasi-classicality, but it got essentially, almost nowhere by that criteria. Lots of interesting things came from this history's approach, but finding a mathematical characterization of quasi-classicality really hasn't advanced very far. It looks very, very hard.
Finding a characterization is one thing, but you're saying to find a unique choice of.
If you had something like. If you had a well-defined measure of quasi-classicality, then maybe you could find a unique choice by saying it's the most quasi-classical set according to my measure. It's not clear that I would give a unique angle, but maybe you're lucky. I suppose.
Is the problem to just have a rough guide to when you call something quasi-classical? Or if you want an actual numerical measure, say, this is 3.02 quasi-classical, this one is 3.25 quasi-classical?
Well, that would be good. But even with a rough guide level, what one would like, you'd like something you could teach a computer to do. So something that you tell it the dynamics, you tell it the initial state. And then it turns away and it says, okay, here's a quasi-classical domain for you.
So you're like quasi-classicality to be a concave function in some way, whatever this is called, and strictly so that there's actually a peak, and that's the one it picks out a unique set of histories.
That would be particular. And maybe it's very hard because it can't. Maybe it's very hard because one's just not looking at something that isn't really there. I don't know. But anyway, it's very hard. And it's not that it hasn't been tried, even with other people have tried. The blood of a noble graduate student is sort of distilled and set out for the next two or three slides. So there are all sorts of things you can try. You could try, for instance, to take some natural partition, H equals H, H tends to HB, sort of idea of exploring again in a different context here. Take the Schmidt decomposition and ask something like, when do Schmidt projections define a consistent set? And that initially seems like quite a promising sort of thing to do. You might think, well, generally they don't, but in measurement type interactions, you'll get a story of consistent tensor separation beforehand, and then a Schmidt decomposition will pick out the point spaces afterwards, and then you can get describe a succession of measurements like that. So, Jim McElwain, whose
paper and taking these diagrams with, put a lot of time and effort into trying to explore that idea with a relatively small dimensional Hilbert space for the system and for the apparatus, a random Hamiltonian interacted between them. This was, by the way, a model that Andy Albrecht earlier used also to try and explore both consistent histories and decoherence and quantum intuitions in general. And some selection rule that said how we're going to pick out approximately consistent sets. Precisely consistent doesn't seem to work because you never get precisely consistent sets. So you need, and if you're going to have approximately consistent sets, you have to parameterize how approximately, so that's the epsilon parameter. And then you run into an immediate problem. You sort of hit you program the computer, and then you look at the output, and then you hit yourself with the head and say, yes, gosh, that was a stupid thing to do. Because the Schmidt decomposition doesn't change, changes only continuously. And so what the thing tries to do, it applies the first Schmidt decomposition, and then it says, aha, just at the next time interval, well, the Schmidt decomposition is almost the same. So I'm just going to repeat that one. And that will be consistent, because essentially nothing's happened. And it'll carry on doing that, and you'll get a completely trivial consistent set in which nothing ever happens. And you realize this wasn't the question you wanted to ask. And so you say, look, I don't want trivial consistent sets. I want you to only give me a new story about history. There's at least some probability that it could have gone both of the possible ways. So then you introduce a delta parameter that tells it, all right, you're not allowed to produce a new history unless there's a probability of at least 0.01 that it will go both of the possible ways. But then it still tends to get pretty stuck. It almost reverts to the previous case, because it waits until it's just at 0.01, and then it says, aha, well, it's still pretty much consistent. It's consistent enough by your criteria, so I'm going to peel off this little history here, and there's a 0.01 history, and the rest of it's gone that way. That's 0.099. Yep.
It's a computer reconstructing the rest of history is So, and then it peels off a few more, and occasionally something more interesting. This one splits into like a quarter or three quarters, but now this one's just peeling off all the way down. And this one actually just goes through another genuine split here, and then starts peeling off all the ones. So you run into that problem. And here's an even worse one, which actually nothing ever happens except the one peeling off. This is allowing it to be less consistent, so that doesn't seem good. And occasionally you sort of fine-tune the parameters a bit, run the random process enough times with random number generator, you get some more interesting history. Here's an interesting looking history. You might think you learn something genuine about physics in that.
But the trouble is, if you change your delta or your epsilon, even by small numbers here, you get a completely different story. There seems to be no stability at all about the sort of picture that emerges. So this looks interesting, but you either get another slew of trivial histories or something that looks interesting that has a completely different structure if you change these things rather to a rather small degree. So maybe there's some better ideas out there. I mean, certainly, I'm sure there are more things that have been tried, but, and maybe fresh approaches would be useful. But it doesn't, so far at least, it's resisted resisted people's ideas, the idea of finding some mathematical definition of the quasi-classical set. So, let's go. So that's why I think it's worth exploring this other approach rather than continuing to look at consistent histories.
Believing that, are you saying that people really just can't even recognize quasi-classical sets? Or,
no, we,
or you can, but you just don't know how to pick out your favorite one.
If you can, sort of case by case, if you, at least for sort of toy or toy-ish models, you can recognize them and you can sort of define them as a theorist. You could say, look, I think this is roughly going to be quasi-classical set. Case by case, but to give a general rule that will work in all cases.
Well, we only need it for standard model with quantum gravity.
Well, to give a general rule that will work for the standard model plus quantum gravity plus some theory of the initial conditions. Nobody's had anything that suggests they don't have to be that. Okay, so what would be the advantages over other approaches? Well, it's mathematically precise, and on that, it beats consistent histories without a selection rule, but it beats Kepler-Leighton. It's in a natural way lorentz covariance, it's plausibly adaptable to quantum gravity, and on that, it beats, I guess, De Broglie and collapse models. It respects conservation laws, and
if you want to do that, then it beats collapse models on that. It has a straightforward story about probability. Either this world is realized, or this one, or this one, or this one. And on that, my current conclusion is at least that it beats Everett, where the story about probability is murky at the very best.
Probability in the Everett interpretation is pretty straightforward effort.
Did you?
Go on, please.
Problem and tails have already discussed. The ontology or phenomenology or model is defined, as I said, in terms of the Ullmann density matrix. So I don't know whether this is a virtue or a vice or whatever, but it's different. It's not having a different mathematical structure of quantum theory, like Borodin, exactly, trajectories, or flash ontologies to collapse model people who are sort of adding the flash to sort of the centers of where the collapses are. And it gives a clear account of ontology from which we can derive as best we can, a clear account of epistemology. And all that today tells us beats epistemic approaches. Okay. So, what's there? First, we've got to choose our favorite preferred factorization. H8 H V. I've listed a few plausible candidates, so it depends slightly whether on context or what are the candidates. So, non-analytics, quantum mechanics, we have a few, and whether this is one of the very few of quantum gravity, and then we knew what we meant by that, we'd have different ones. But here are a few fermions, tensor bosons, bosonic freedom, massive particles versus massless particles, matter and radiational gauge particles, matter and gravity and quantum gravity.
Fermions versus bosons, wouldn't you you'd normally associate fermions with an anti-symmetric subspace of some big tensor particle space, and bosons with a symmetric.
No,
or you mean
that would be net fermion number odd versus net fermion number even.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of something like a tensor sort of Fock space picture. I mean, if you have fermion creation operators, they're living, so speaking, the fermion component and boson creation operators, the boson component, to get some state that's got both fermions and bosons in it. It's a joke of it, not true of tensor product of, or sum of some of the products and of space in those two forms. Yeah.
Why are you listing matter and radiation and fermions and bosons as separate? Would that be the common understanding that fermions are matter and bosons?
I suppose I wanted to be open on this, but you look at this stuff out there, we don't have it. Maybe there are bosons that do other things.
And you want to factorization into just two parts? Just two parts.
Just two parts.
And that's crucial. That is crucial.
Good question. I've only really thought it through for two parts. Maybe you can find subvariants on this for more factors. I'm not so sure you can, but maybe I haven't worked with some of the averages on it. For what I'm going to say anyway, the rest of this talk is going to be crucial. It's just 2 months. Okay, second thing we're going to see is there's some preferred basis.
So this is both of these things we're thinking of as law-like. Our theory tells us to split the Hilbert space into one of these tensor products. And it also picks out some preferred basis, which may, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, depend on time, may, in relativistic quantum mechanics, depend on the hypersurface, on this second factor, HB. Again, you could generate a list of naturalist candidates. Photon or radiation, well, you could think of the position or momentum bases. Quite generally, whatever HA and HB are, you could think of the Schmidt basis for HB, defined by the Schmidt composition at the time T or on the hypersurface you're interested in, and a few others. But again, not an enormous list. And it's good. And it's a sort of scientific virtue that there are relatively few in each case, in that it just means we have to go through case by case, and after we've exhausted those lists, if we haven't got something that does what we were hoping to do, then the program's over and it failed. Yeah.
A natural candidate for such a decomposition. What are the features you're looking for?
You have a strong list, I think, sense of idea. I mean,
not in this. I really don't know what it's supposed to do, but it's apparently you have some implicit criteria which is giving
relatively
few.
Well, it's... it's an aesthetic judgment, but defining up into matter and gravitons seems like a sort of reasonably natural division of time. Dividing stuff up into Canadian property and the rest of the world doesn't.
How about this one? The observer versus everything else?
I had a great...
That would have been acceptable.
It would not be.
It would be more like Canadian property.
It would be much more like Canadian property. Did you want to comment on that? I mean...
comment,
presumably the division is sort of for the entire universe.
Yes. So
that would be a very solipsistic, adaptive observer to find.
Yeah. I should say, I mean... thank you, actually. I mean, just to sort of reinforce that. Our whole ontology is going to live in HA, by the way. It's going to be density matrices on HA. So we particularly don't, unless we are genuinely solipsists, we particularly don't want to observe it against the rest of the universe.
Yeah,
since our ontology would then reduce to a story about the observer.
Oh, that's interesting. The ontology lives on one side, the other stuff is.
The other stuff is on the side.
Ghost stuff.
Yeah.
But the preferred basis will depend in general on the state. It's not like the Rolle-Bonne
case. That's not true in all cases. For the Schmidt basis, of course, that's right. But for the, if you choose, say, the photon position basis or the momentum basis, that's state independent. I have some more technical questions around this to Chris. The 7-5, is that right?
Well, that's good to
so in the past we tend to go on a bit, like half past 5 in the morning, especially this discussion training as well. So
how about
somewhere in, well, yeah, okay, people should. free to leave it without it. Maybe we'll see how it goes. But yeah, okay, so where are we? Factorization for the basis.
I'm not sure you want to use quotes out of position. A lot of people will jump up, probably with an irrelevant objection. There are no, quote unquote, are no position observables for quote times.
Yeah.
There are observed positions for quote times.
What?
There are observed positions for quote times.
Maybe, yes, but there are no positions, nevertheless, in some sense.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. So, photon momentum, we're happy with?
Just get rid of the word photon,
like
particle.
Well, I mean, does it matter? That's not my question. Does it matter which one is HA and which is HB? Would it be equally good if the fermions were HB and the photons?
That's a good question. I tried to say a little bit about this place in the archive paper. In principle, it could make a big difference. On the other hand, if you want to describe the classical world, it's actually not so clear. You can recover a reasonable account of it from the electromagnetic fields, maybe different, I mean, sorry about the matter, or the other way around. I mean, the way we tend to think about it is that we're going to describe classical worlds, we're going to talk about the massive particles and the densities of chemical species and so on. But then all the atoms have electromagnetic field associated with them, and so the information should be pretty much encoded and the other way around. So maybe one should probably look at most of these things both ways around, just on the same side.
And also, would you be equally happy with, say, electric field position observables instead of photon position? Because no one would dispute that as well.
So,
do you think that would make a big difference?
I don't think that's strong enough intuition of that. So, yeah, we'll.
Yeah, but can I ask you just a clarifying question?
Yeah.
Now it sounds like you're talking about a particular basis in one of these, in the decomposition.
Yeah.
That's also part of the speculation?
Yeah. Yeah.
The decomposition and the preferred basis.
Nature has degree to that. Just, so we're definitely adding extra structure. I guess one did reports about that. The more infrastructure you add, the bigger the price you pay, and so we should keep that into record. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Also, one last one.
Yeah.
Is it important if we think of this in the Heisenberg versus the Schrödinger picture? Because the preferred basis in one is not the same thing as the preferred basis in the other.
Right. Just a personal confession, I tend to sort of think of things in the Schrodinger picture, but I imagine it doesn't. You write, of course, you better be clear which picture you're in. I don't think it really matters which picture you work in, as long as you make the appropriate translation for all the bases.
And one will be a time dependent basis.
Uh-huh.
If you make the change.
Yeah, but that's not.
Are you allowing a time dependent
basis? Yeah. Okay, so the intuition is
something like this. If you think about what's going on in this room, or what happens in a quantum experiment where a pointer goes one way or the other at the end of it, all the information about that is quickly dissipates, right, it's quickly carried away into the environment, copied into the environment in multiply redundant ways, in the sort of way that decoherence theorists have been telling us for many years. So, Wojciech and Robin and others have been elaborating lately. And it's essentially never erased. In principle, if only you understood all the details and had enough time and enough computational power, you could track what was happening in this room from the states of the photon fields far away in the future, far away in space and time. And the intuition is that our preferred basis, which might be, say, photon momenta, in principle, allows you to tell a story about the whole quasi-classical world as it evolved throughout time. So, although you don't know yet how you're doing it, if you carry out, you don't know yet how to do the computation, if you were able to run the universe and then carry out measurement of all the photon momenta asymptotically as T goes to infinity, at least in if the universe is expanding forever, the intuition is that would be enough, that measurement would be enough to give you information about which quasi-classical world were realized. So we have a way of labeling the possible different worlds, the possible different branches, namely by their final states. And their final states are defined as the possible different outcomes of the measurement in the preferred basis as t goes to infinity. Okay, so having we have a way of labeling them, and now we want to, say what happens not at t goes to infinity, but at finite times. Well, we infer a story about finite times from an algorithm, which I'll describe in a moment, that uses pre and post selection, uses the fact that the pre-selected data for all the branches is the same, it's the initial state, and the post-selected data for all the branches is different. It's their final state, which is one of the orthogonal states, corresponding to one of the possible outcome states of the asymptotic preferred basis measurement. Okay, so those are pre-selected states, our initial. Here are our possible post-selected states. I've used slightly sort of abusive notation here, but psi infinity is, so to speak, the asymptotic evolution of psi. These are the possible measurements. I have the identity acting on the first factor and pi acting on the second. So I'm going to call these states psi I infinity, and I is the label for the branches. And as I said, these are orthogonal for all the different branches I. Okay, so now I promised an algorithm to say how we're going to use those data to describe branch states at finite t. Well, what we do is we calculate what the outcome probabilities would be were we to carry out a measurement on that second factor at any finite time t in the preferred basis at that time t. Okay, so we're doing calculations as though a measurement were being carried out in that basis of time t. But we're certainly not assuming that these measurements actually do take place and do collapse the state. We just want to extract some numbers by hypothetically, counterfactually considering what would happen if those measurements were to take place. Okay, so what you get from that, for any given branch I, so again, branch I, that labels the branches, is a list of outcome probabilities, outcome J, corresponding to the different preferred basis elements, so the different projections, finite time t. And from those, we can construct the corresponding states. Let's call them psi j of t, just by taking the relevant projections, acting them on psi of t, where this is the unitarily evolved quantum state. So psi of 0 e to the minus I h t over h bar goes in here. Preferred basis projections get applied here. That gives us these. Okay, so as I say, these measurements aren't actually happening. That isn't the picture. But we've got a rule that gives us two things we're going to use. One of them is the PIs, and the other one the psi j's. Okay, so I want to carry these two things across to the next slide and put them together like so. Here are the PIs, the probabilities, and now the psi j's. Well, I'm going to make what in a direct notation would be the ket bra state like so, and then trace it over HB so that this thing is a density matrix. This thing here is a density matrix on HA. Normalize it, that's all what the thing in the bottom is doing. Sum over all the possible outcomes J and weight it by these PIs. That is it's an operator on HA. You can easily convince yourself it's a density matrix. It's normalized, self-adjoint, and so on. Okay, so here we have density matrix. what's the intuition? The intuition here is that by this procedure, well, the states with significant probability are states whose current environment component is consistent with the asymptotic environment state of the relevant branch. And the states with low probability are states whose current environment component already excludes them really being part of that branch, pretty much. So if the pointer could have gone this way or it could have gone this way, and the final state is saying in the photon record the pointer pretty much necessarily went this way, then this state is going to be essentially excluded. It's going to have essentially zero probability because its current photon momentum are already telling a different story about the pointer from the one that the final state has told us. But this one will survive. This one will make a significant contribution. And we're selecting out here.
Selecting the future. Well, that's trying to describe what the algorithm is doing rather than a story about causality. So the algorithm, and let me stick to that language. The algorithm says identify new branches by the final environment state, but now you want to look at earlier times and see what the branch state is at some earlier time. We'll look at the environment state at that time and see, roughly speaking, whether it's consistent or not with the final state that we've already identified. So some of them will be and some of them won't be, and the ones that are not won't really contribute to this state, the ones that are will. Did that complete? Was that complete your thought, or was it spirit of the question?
I guess that was spirit of my question. Yeah. I don't understand it physically because I understand we can start with the current states and including its environment, and that has many possible futures. It would be consistent with it.
It has many
possible. I don't have different environments that give rise to different.
You're right. It has many possible futures that are consistent with it. But there are also an even larger list of possible features that are not consistent. Why? Well, because the future already knows stuff about the past that isn't consistent with this current.
So that's what I don't understand. How does the future know about the past?
Well, for instance, we think of any sort of plausible kind of cosmology, the structure. The local arrangements of galaxies could be very different from the way they are now. That would already be evident in the correlations of the microwave background and in the photon background now, and it will continue being evident right the way through to the end of time. So in that sense, just looking at the photon background, asymptotically as t goes to infinity, you can learn stuff not only about the present, but about even quite a large part.
If I take the present and I look at all futures that are consistent with the present, then how can I go to one of those futures and say, well, some of them are more consistent with the present than others?
Mathematically, that's just a fact, isn't it? Some of them are more consistent with them. But others in the sense that we can calculate conditional probabilities and some of them are large and some of them are small.
If
you just basically building in determinism into your question with plausibility, that's what it sounds, because your comments on this sounded like yes, you can predict the future from the present and you can predict the past from the present. You have a deterministic theory. And you're putting in correlations like this because you want your brain just to look.
You will always look quasi-deterministic and quasi-classical. There is still randomness coming in there from the quantum level, but they follow good approximation, reasonably deterministic laws most of the time. As it, in the same sense, it's quasi-classical related.
So this is a general framework brought out by Bell, which should be satisfied for any realistic interpretation, big collapse or whatever. And that's that you have a variable.
Yep.
And that variable has one configuration at each moment of time.
What's the word configuration doing here?
You have a variable, and that variable can take on lots of different values or whatever it is. And that, so the variable occupies a point in some kind of state space. So
it doesn't need to be a classical state space.
No, yeah. it can be whatever. But the necessary requirement of that variable is that you could read off positions uniquely of macroscopic objects. So, for example,
approximately,
yes. So in your version, what would be the variable from which I could uniquely? But that's a probability, right?
No, that's a density matrix.
It's a density matrix, yes. But so that would be a probability, something here or something there. So if you cannot uniquely from that object tell if it's exactly there or there. So it's not the variable in this cell.
You're happy.
You have to tell me what that probability of.
You have to tell me something first.
Okay.
Are you happy with wave functions of big variables? Which they all, I think, was. Were you happy with, say, for instance, the GW wave function being available?
So if I said that, I should be able to read off one definite macroscopic reality, not like the models, for example, then, of course, it, something like a collapse would do it. Then the wave function could be taken as a variable.
Okay, so
there is at least.
So what?
Forgetting about this Taylor problem and so on, there is at least one way.
Yeah. So what's the crucial distinction between pure states and mixed states? So if you're unhappy with density matrices,
well, it's a bit. If I'm given a probability, it has to be a probability of something, and that's exactly the variable. So it looks like you're not giving me the variable here, you're giving me a probability of something, but then you're saying, I don't know what it is about.
I think AJ might claim that row I has an approximate localized density. For a fixed case,
that's
not a superposition.
But I'm just wondering if there's some confusion in what I said earlier. I mean, we have. Can I try this trick again? We have two things, we have the set of PIs, and we have the set of row I. Two. So when we carry out the asymptotic projection in the preferred basis, t equals infinity, we obtain prime states, but we also obtain Born probabilities. Those are the PIs. So these are probabilities. The branches labeled by I. Okay. Once you decide which branch you're in, so once, so to speak, nature has rolled the dice and selected one using this distribution, it's described just by the evolving row I of t. So there's t and the left. Yes, there's t. And there, so to speak, this axis, so to speak, measures the matrices. So I just wanted to clarify, I mean, there is a story about probabilities, but it's already encapsulated in the PIs. You should not look at the row I and say, well, what the row I is telling me is that the state is in, there's some further story about probabilities, that the state is really in one of these 17 different pure states with some less probabilities, but Adrian's just refusing to tell me how that goes. That's not it. This is the variable ontology. There's no more story about probabilities, pure
from
states attached.
From that row I will. If you give me a row I, this algorithm would work out. So that yes, that the need is here now.
Yeah. Okay. I know that's what the program said. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, John, what point in the history of the universe does the stochastic element enter?
There's always this. You can ask this question about any indeterministic theory, right? When Boltz rolled in her dice, when did she roll it? Is it the start of time, or the end of time, or what time's going on, or something else? And I don't have a clearer answer in this case than I would have in any other indeterministic theory. If you want me to give some answer, I say I would say something else. I mean, it's just, it's like he rolls the dice and then and decides which universe to bring into creation. And until then, we have nothing, and then just a void, and then here comes the universe. I don't think you should think, well, we run through time once, and then we roll the dice at the end, and then we run through it again to try and work out what actually happened the first time. I mean, that doesn't seem like a sort of meaningful or useful story about time probabilities. And again, am I answering the right question or a stupid question?
Well, I'm just trying to get a sense as to how this works. You've got somewhere in the background, you've also got the evolution of the state, the unitary evolution of the state, all the
right. Universe. As you do in the program.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But somehow, out of that set of possible branches, one of them is actualized.
Right. But I feel the mathematics right. That doesn't mean you don't have to translate that into some sort of teleological story about the ontology that says somehow stuff really starts happening in the future and then works its way backwards to the past. But it might not be scary.
So, can I ask the evolution of that rho I is dependent on the wave function?
It's dependent on everything. I mean, yes, it's dependent on the initial.
Yeah.
It's dependent on the initial state, and it's dependent on the dynamics.
So the criteria one uses, for example, to say that the wave function is really the Boyle ball is that an individual, the evolution of an individual depends on the wave function. So, therefore, you would say, well, the wave function is really in some sense. So you would say the same thing here, right?
It can't
be interpreted as a probability distribution because the evolution of individuals shouldn't depend on what ensemble is a member of. That is what psi. So if you assume that psi is a probability distribution, it sort of doesn't make sense.
Okay, so I'm a bit agnostic, both in the broader and here, and maybe it's clear since we understand what the metaphor is clear second there. There's one, I know it's probably minority, but there's one view of the Broadbone that thinks of the wave function as a sort of law-like rather than part of the ontology. That says all was real, but a Bohmian trajectories. That seems to be a perfectly consistent story. I just don't know whether I should take it more or less seriously or as seriously as the more standard story that says that. Part of the ontology.
Well, you can actually do calculations sort of with a wave function, like you can make a process different ways where the trajectory is constant, etc. So it's sort of a dynamical entity. Well, I think it's hard pressed point of view. And even the Goldsteins who are promoting that view is not happy with it in the ordinary non-logistic quantum theory. They would like to say that when things become finalized in quantum gravity, anything like that, then you may take something such. So they
would,
I don't think that they
can
point
to you in knowledge. Well, my suspicion is whoever those discussions have played in Bone 3, they're going to play out in a pretty much parallel way.
Yeah.
Does that help? Yeah. Can we go back to the formula? What is that? I think I missed some of the definitions. So rho I of t is the reality or whatever, the true density matrix at time t, given that you're in the I branch.
Given you're in the I branch.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And the branches, are there branches on a finite label or is there a continuum of branches?
Well, that depends on whether the dimension of HB is finite or infinite.
Well, in your example, it seems to be
infinite. So, presumably, realistically, too. So the I is already part of a probability density rather than discrete.
Yeah, okay. And then what is this thing on the extreme right? It's got two underlines, two yellow underlines.
Pi and JT, that's something we calculated in the previous slide. It's here. those, given that we're in branch I, given, so given we have co-selected on some final state, but then it's branch I, we can ask what the probabilities would be if we were to carry out a measurement in the preferred base distance from T. That depends on both the branch and which outcome you're interested in. So the outcome we generate from the branch.
So this is the probability of getting in that same base, in that same distinguished base.
Remember the basis might be time dependent. So in the relevant basis.
That was a further confusion. In the relevant basis,
yeah.
The probability of getting the jth outcome at time t, if you were in the ith branch, is that it?
Yeah.
Good.
So it's just the overlap between, it's the overlap between the J basis element and the I basis elements. In the I state at time t.
But of course, there's lots of dynamics going on between.
The formula part is just the inner product of size of the I with basis element J at time t squared, is that?
Providing your size of I includes e to the minus I, your probability to the minus I, h to e.
The above.
So, I mean, can you talk about these words like outcome measurements and so on? I'm just wondering if there's some vagueness and so on here. So, probability is defined, that's the probability for outcome J on branch. So, how do you understand outcomes? Is that sort of being made precise by the coherence, or
I just want to apply the mathematics to the projection logic. So maybe it would be better not to use the word measurement, but so we have a projected decomposition of the identity. Mm-hmm. We calculate probabilities by taking trace of the density matrix with PI, that's probability of outcome I. The post outcome state is PI psi, normalized.
So,
it's all mathematics.
It's all mathematics, and then you just write outcome there to be descriptive.
So one reason, the main reason whatsoever there's an entails problem is because we've got this density matrix thing emerging rather than a wave function. And so the possibility, which was already touched on earlier, it's possible even the wave function which might be a bit higher entails in the noise, but it's much more plausible that you can do that, and much less evident that it's even a worry when you're dealing with a somewhat different density matrix. If you have a density matrix that's quite large, it's got components all over the place, you add a rather small one to it, it's not clear that you can actually reconstruct the small one from the side in the same way you can identify the small component superposition. And that probably is a good place as I need to stop. Time is getting on, and I hope I've given at least some of the intuitions as to why this is kind of sensible thing to study, and some of the ingredients to go into it. So there's pre and post selection, and sort of thing that Aharonov and others have thought of as a possible ingredient for a solution that we've thought for a long time. There's a preferred factorization, which the modalists in particular have been interested in. There's the idea of some extra stuff defining ontology on that wave function, which looks rather like a Bohmian idea. There's a picture that emerges, it's something like a collapse model, but it's not a collapse model given by a simple time, a simple stochastic differential of time. It's just something that says the state and becomes things that look rather like collapses, but in a way that doesn't violate any conservation, because all we're doing in the end is pre and post. Good place to start.
limitations?
What one needs to do, I guess, now is play about with models that are simple enough that you can actually do computation, but rich enough that you can get some idea of whether quantum classical structure is emerging. You wouldn't expect different predictions for quantum mechanics in the sense that you're helping make different predictions. You'd expect richer predictions than what they're able to work out than we've previously been able to make, because you can actually start playing around with cosmological models and looking at the sorts of quantum classical models that emerge. But it doesn't predict any deviation from conservation models. It doesn't predict that macroscopic superpositions the macro interference of macroscopic objects is impossible.
Does anyone make richer predictions in that sense?
I would say no, because Everett alone doesn't give you a story about how to talk about the quasi-classical structures and quasi-classical worlds. That goes back to the sort of phenomenology versus ontology thing. Even in Everett, we're still lacking an account of how you actually start with the cosmological model and then end up with a story about what sort of worlds could have emerged from it.
So, related to this, how do you test this theory? I mean, you don't get a mismatch with the experiment, you just go back and say, well, maybe I have a decomposition model on the basis model, or is that not going to impact? I'm not quite clear how the analysis goes.
Well,
but there's all that angular structure, and it seems like there's a thread that you can pull
around. Yeah. So, I think if this works at all, it's just a solution measurement problem within what would basically be understood as standard quantum thing. Either it fails completely, in which case it just doesn't give you stories about quantum classical structure, or it reproduces the predictions you make in Copenhagen wherever they're applicable.
Well, just again to try to get a sense as to what's going on in terms of a kind of a Hubble story. I'm just trying to understand the nature of your God who created a world where the fundamental element of the world has to say that the solution of the fundamental equation of motion of the universe is a wave function for the entire universe because it's being governed by the Schrödinger equation. That contains many branches. The branch that's selected by God is being affected by the mathematical presence at least of all the other branches, because they're in the universal wave function that's evolving over time, and that's going to appear in your formulas, the default state. So God is creating a single branch which depends for its fortune on the other branches that don't exist. I'm just trying to get a sense as to, I'm not saying there's anything incoherent here, I'm just trying to get a sense as to what God is doing. That's what God seems to be doing.
Just as in other stories about how quasi-classical worlds cease to affect one another, to the extent that the branches really are permanently separate, they're not really involved even in the probability form. But you're right in principle, of course, that's right. You need all psi, you need all of the unitary dynamics in order to apply these rules. So God is, and that's a worry, I think, perhaps in, well, to the extent it's a worry here, it's a worry in Bohm theory, it's a worry in all the other tests too. But perhaps it is a seem a weird way to make a world.
But I mean, it's very interesting in the sense that GRW is a sequence of stochastic events where once one occurs, that's it. All the other possibilities that could have existed no longer play any role. You start from scratch.
I have to say, the more I talk to everybody here, the more confused I get about interpretism. But, I mean, that's what. GRW seems to sort of let me tell a story about that, but Is there a genuine distinction here? I mean, here's another story you could tell about geography. You could say, here is a list of all the possible time dynamical evolutions for all time, and here's a probability law that picks out one of them. That's certainly an alternative phrasing. Okay, is there any difference actually between that phrasing and the one you used there?
Time t prime. What the nature of the world is depends in all the dynamics on what happened at time t, where at time t certain possibilities would be ruled out and never figure again. Because the state has collapsed and you start the evolution all over again with the collapsed state, and it will collapse in the future again. But it's not as if you have a collective memory that's going to have some dynamical effect on the future of those things that have been ejected, have been annihilated by the collapse.
Except insofar as they're still there in the tails.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, they're in the tails.
Yeah. But I think, does this help? I mean, it does seem as though GLW is more consistent with the idea of physics as a process. So some sort of story about physical reality is something that takes place through time, than some picture like this one. Whether that's a good quality or desirable quality.
Insofar as you accept there is a problem with the tails in geodesy, insofar as there is a problem. And the problem is that it has, you know, every one of the elements of the superposition, no matter what their relative advantage is, the two elements of the superposition have all the structure that's required to define definite outcomes and so on. Insofar as there is a problem there, it's simply because you are taking these two elements of the superposition as being real. And again, the same intuition would lead you to say, well, all the elements, all the branches in the universal wave functions are all unitarily. You go into your calculations and likewise.
But maybe it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing. I think that, in a certain way of thinking about quantum mechanics, that is the characteristic of quantum mechanics. That what actually happens, especially in history's way of thinking, that what actually happens in some sense is in some dependence on what doesn't happen. So I think we could see that as a positive picture.
It kind of challenges what you normally understand by the word doesn't happen, the phrase doesn't happen. The general question is, would it be fair to say that macroscopic events that did not leave permanent records won't have a being in this account, in this ontology?
Yes, it would say something.
Not only permanent record, but in that special basis, it has to be.
Yeah, so it would have to be. Somehow, against everything we currently understand, you were able to make macroscopic superpositions, but just left no trace in the environment. The ontology would not tell a story about how it collapsed one or the other. It would tell a story about it still being in superposition for a long time. I don't think that's a bad thing, actually. I mean, that's what's wrong with that story? Maybe that's precisely what I'm talking about. Magically speaking, macroscopic superpositions, but.
I'm not sure it's bad, but it bothers me. Thinking in this other interpretation, this color-based interpretation that I promised to tell you about sometimes, we can actually prove a theorem that you recover classical behavior, classical logic for the kind of event that is recorded in that sense. But it bothers me that, suppose something very different happens in the distant future, so that these records are not there. Suppose the universe doesn't expand. And it wipes out. Is it really important? Is it really going to be important to what exists in our macroscopic world today, whether or not that's the kind of work? I mean, if you tell me not to worry, that'll be great, because then the theorem that we have will be all the stronger and more persuasive for recovering classical reality. But I still think it is something to worry about.
Okay, so if So not just in a special, some sort of special case where we manage to sustain the macroscopic superposition, but in general, we can't reconstruct present data from future records because of something about cosmology recollections. I agree that's a big worry, and maybe if the world is that way, then maybe this line of interpretation isn't useful, and we should throw it away. Well, we get over the words that way, so.
So economically a prediction, or this is right, it's like a prediction that the world is that. So you can draw some cosmological deduction. We won't have time to test.
Yeah. So I mean at the moment it seems to be the measurement problem is so stubborn and so intractable, but I'm happy that I'd be delighted if one could show that modulo some plausible hypotheses about cosmology and other stuff. You've got a solution to the measurement problem. And if those plausible hypotheses turn out to be wrong, then well, but you do the best anyway. So the plausible hypothesis, essentially, is that indeed, for a sensible definition of HB, as the environment really does record arbitrary files. But we don't know that for sure.
Then there was this more technical. Why didn't you do the following thing, which would have been a little simpler? There must be a reason that I'm not getting it. Go to the future, have God throw her dice and select one particular branch. And then that, do your projection then. That gives you a density matrix. And then just develop it backward in time and call that the current density matrix at time t. You didn't quite do that, you did something that was more elaborate.
I didn't do that, and that sounds more like the sort of thing that I know than other people, so, or at least part of the sort of thing that they talk about. So the trouble with that is that would say that the density matrix of time t already has data about how all the future measurements are going to pan out, but encoded in, there's some story about a quasi-classical world now, right now, that's actually written there into our fundamental ontology that's saying, describing all future measurement outcomes. And, well, perhaps it's an ontological story, but it's not terrible, but as a story about the classical world, it doesn't seem to be what we want. We want to say that measurements we think of as already having happened, out there in the story, but stuff that's yet to happen is not. We have this dimension describing that. The stuff that's already become quasi-classical, but not the stuff that's yet to become quasi-classical.
So is that an aesthetic difference, or is there an actual practical? Would you actually expect some weird things to happen because the present density matrix has to capture all this extra information?
I think for the phenomenology or model side of the program, I think you really don't want to do things that way. For the ontology side,
you don't mean there would be an actual practical difference.
Well, it wouldn't be giving you what you really want, which is an intelligible description of evolving quasi-classical structure. But for the ontology side, I'm really confused about that.
I mean, you're saying the story would really be different? You start with scale and variance fractional fluctuations, and then there's just all rows of the fluctuations. Over densities form and under densities form, and acoustic peaks. And all the things saying that story would actually come out different if you use that simpler description.
Maybe they'll need a cup of coffee in an hour to reflect on this and get back to it. It's a good question. So I'll think about it.
I think we should let the speaker have his coffee.